Welcome to the latest episode of Vox Talks Climate Finance. With me, Tim Phillips, and hello over at Cornell, my co-host Alyssa Klein-Einhaus.
Hi, Tim. Greetings from the budding spring in Ithaca.
Today, we are talking about climate tipping points and their implications for finance.
With us today, we have Tim Lenton, who is the Chair of Climate Change and Earth System Science at the University of Exeter. And we also have with us today Patrick Bolton, who is a professor of finance and economics at the Imperial College London Business School, and he's also the research director of the Centre for Climate Finance in Investment at Imperial College London. So Timothy Lenton is one of the most renowned global authorities on climate tipping points, also known for his work on planetary boundaries. He recently wrote a report entitled Global Tipping Points. Patrick is one of the pioneers and global thought leaders in climate finance. He wrote the Green Swan Report, arguing that going long carbon creates radical uncertainty in climatic outcomes and economic outcomes, so it's not prudent. Welcome, Patrick, and welcome, Tim.
Hey, hi there.
Thank you. Thank you, Alyssa.
So let's talk about the science of climate tipping points first. Tim, what is a climate tipping point?
Well, a tipping point in general, Alyssa, is where a small change makes a big difference to the state or the fate of a system. So a climate tipping point is when, for example, a little bit of extra global warming tips a part of the climate system into a very different state. So that could mean tipping the loss of a major ice sheet, and like on Greenland or West Antarctica, tipping the reorganization of part of the circulation of the ocean or the atmosphere, or tipping the loss of a major biome, like, for example, the Amazon rainforest or coral reefs in the tropics.
Those ones that you just identified, are they the most important ones? Is there a sort of a table of the most important tipping points?
Well, we've come up with a rather now large map or list of tipping points in the climate. I think the most important needs to be answered in the sense of risk. So consider both their likelihood, their impacts, the number of people or other living things vulnerable to those impacts and how vulnerable they are to them. So on those counts, I can certainly tell you the closest ones or the ones we think are most likely would be triggering the irreversible melt of the Greenland and West Antarctic ice sheets, which is certainly important because in the long run that could commit us to more than 10 metres of sea level rise. The thawing of the permafrost, the frozen soils of the high Arctic, certainly important in the sense that that can release enough carbon dioxide and methane to significantly add to global warming. Tipping the loss of coral reefs in the tropics, well, that's 500 million people's livelihoods right there, so that's pretty important. And then there's a tipping point in part of the circulation of the North Atlantic Ocean that would certainly be a bit of a catastrophe here in the UK, as it would make the climate a lot more seasonal, like snowier, colder winters, yet hotter heat waves and more persistent in the summers. That said, there are other really big tipping points out there that we're not so sure are so close, but are even worse than the ones I just reeled off. And the big one is to tip what's called the Atlantic Meridional Overturning Circulation, which sounds slightly esoteric, but it's the transports of massive amount of heat between the Southern Hemisphere and the Northern Hemisphere in the Atlantic, and basically connects the whole climate system together. So when you tip that, you tip monsoon in the tropics, often to collapse, and you have a whole load of other profoundly bad repercussions.
So could you explain to us what the climate implications are if one or more of these tipping points would be crossed?
It kind of depends, as you heard, a bit on the system. But what we're really talking about is a set of tipping points which, if you tip them, you're really altering the whole state of the climate. And that can mean what we recognize as the pattern of seasonality or climate in a given location. If for some of these tipping points in the circulation of the ocean and the atmosphere coupled together, if we tip the loss of major ice sheets, we're committing to change the outline of the coastlines of the world, to have to ultimately move major megacities like Shanghai or London or New York.
Oh, biggie.
Nothing small. Yeah, nothing to worry about there, folks. And talking about tipping the loss of major biomes, bits of the living planet, is kind of profound. You're tipping away a load of evolutionary potential in the sense of that you're dispensing with potentially millions of species. And so you're taking away some of the reservoir for life to bounce back and evolve whatever happens in the unfolding climate story or catastrophe. But you're also fundamentally damaging our life support system. nature is busy doing a load of stuff for us that we barely recognize and hardly have a value in our economic calculations, like cycling all the nutrients and water and stuff we need to flourish and so on.
Tim, this sounds like absolute disaster movie stuff. The implications for the people on the planet.
We're talking about, as usual with climate change, unjust implications, because tipping points tend to have impacts that can be much stronger in some places than others, although we're all going to feel it. The people who are less well off in the global south are already more vulnerable anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And in some of these cases of tipping points, they're right at the sharp end. My mind or my concerns tend to go first to the people who are already most vulnerable. And so I'd be deeply concerned about the risks there are, for example, to tip collapse of the monsoon in West Africa, or it'd be a humanitarian catastrophe in the Sahel, or to tip disruption of the monsoon in India, which is possible. It's been seen in paleoclimate records. Again, that would be an absolute human catastrophe and it could unfold alarmingly quickly. But yeah, for each tipping point, I could probably reel off a bunch of human consequences and begin to get more specific about who gets hurt first or worst.
Mm.
What you might take from that is these have geopolitical ramifications, because if you get a tipping point that disproportionately harms some nations or people whilst not harming others, well, that carries its own implications in terms of shifting power. And that's one of the reasons I've been looking at the tipping point in the North Atlantic circulation that would disproportionately harm Western Europe, especially the UK and the US, because that would, without having quite such bad implications for, say, China or a bunch of other countries I could reel off, well, that's one thing that can shift the balance of power in a world where it's shifting anyway.
If we cross some of these tipping points, is it possible to get back to the old equilibrium state by negative emissions? And if so, how negative would these emissions need to be and for how long?
Please say it is, Tim.
I'm going to tell you it depends on the system. So it's a really great question. And I often try to get people to evoke the image of the Roadrunner cartoon of Wile E. Coyote, because sometimes he comes flying off the edge of the cliff and hovers in midair for a few seconds before falling precipitously to the ground. And you imagine if you could reach your arm out and grab him, you could just rescue him from the tipping. Now, crucially, this is about the timescales of systems. I talked about, for example, the risk of tipping the meltdown of major ice sheets. Well, ice sheets are intrinsically very slow things from a human perspective. You might have all seen the time-lapse photography of glaciers slowly moving but being sped up, so we can relate to the fact that the ice is actually moving. Those slow systems, you have a better chance to overshoot what we would call the equilibrium tipping point and still be able to recover the situation with, say, negative emissions. It depends. You get a window of opportunity that is a function of how far you overshoot and for how long. The more you overshoot, the shorter the window. But it means we might be able to rescue the situation with regard to these commitments to long-term sea level rise. But it also means that for fast systems, which mean, for example, the surface circulation of the ocean, the atmosphere is super fast, and biomes or ecosystems, they can respond pretty quickly. You don't really get much window of opportunity to try and rescue the situation. You get some, we would call it lag in those systems, that we could be forcing them as fast or even faster than they could respond in the case of some ecosystems. So that means they've not actually caught up with the forcing. And if we can bring the forcing down before they catch up, we're just about get away with it. But yeah, for tipping a monsoon, you feel the consequences pretty fast. A little bit of hope there, but with all due caveats.
Yeah, we're busting through these deadlines that we're giving ourselves, 1.5 degrees, 2 degrees. I think a lot of people think about that as, well, we just have to adapt a little bit more. What you're saying, if I understand it correctly, is that as we break through these temperature limits that we've set ourselves, we start to break things that can't be fixed.
That's right. And we create some changes that they're not in the realm of something we can adapt to. They're what we would term loss and damage. And that we already see cases of this unfolding in the world around us now, where insurance is being withdrawn or whatever. Some of these things there's conceivable adaptation to, but you have to be careful and broaden your definition of adaptation. Maybe the best adaptation is I've got to leave where I am because it's underwater now, or it's fundamentally become uninhabitable and I've got to go somewhere else. That's always been one of the best kinds of adaptation, to migrate. They need to have the means to be able to move, but actually being able to move out of trouble is a great thing. Well, it's a great thing as long as other people welcome in wherever they arrive, which would appear to be a little bit of a problem in our current world. You want to avoid the unmanageable and manage the unavoidable. And that's where we're at with tipping points. We'll probably fail to avoid some of them, and we just have to try and work out how best we can manage what unfolds. But we've still got a huge amount to play for in trying to avoid some of the ones that really would be unmanageable.
There are now all these decarbonization pathways that allow for some degree of overshoot, let's say above 1.5 degrees or above 2 degrees. So do they properly account for tipping points when devising these overshoot scenarios? Because to me, they seem dangerous.
The short answer, Alyssa, is no, they don't. As a rule, and you're right, that could be a profound danger or risk if you've not thought that through. There is a little bit of work on one element of this, which is if you start triggering more abrupt thaw of the permafrost, you can release enough carbon to add significantly to warming. So you're fighting against yourself. But what we're talking about here, it comes down to what tools we're using. Typical scenarios are generated from these things we call integrated assessment models, and they have to simplify the climate element anyway, as well as they try to simplify and crudely represent some elements of the macroeconomy. If our state-of-the-art climate models are already struggling to do tipping points properly, and the integrated assessment models are a crude simplification of those models, then for sure they tend to miss a load of the tipping point stuff. And anyway, when we come to talk about the financial sector, there's a bigger problem. They're tending to use a very confined subset of the scenario space that just misses a whole lot of what can quite plausibly unfold.
In your work, you also speak of climate tipping point cascades. What are they and how likely are they to take place?
Put a load of dominoes on their end, tip one domino and the rest fall over. That's like the worst case scenario if a climate tipping point has causal consequences that might cause another tipping point, that might cause another and cause another. That would be the worst kind of tipping point cascade. But luckily, we don't think it's completely wired up that badly, the Earth system or the climate. But we definitely see evidence that tipping one thing can make tipping another more likely. And to give you a concrete example, we're seeing the Arctic warming up at like 4 times as fast as the global average. And that's a lot to do with the fact that you replace a highly reflective ice surface with a dark ocean that absorbs loads of sunlight. That Arctic amplification of warming is why the Greenland ice sheet is melting at an accelerating rate. That's pouring a load of fresh water into the North Atlantic. But also the fact that the Arctic's warming means that air is holding more moisture. We're getting more rain and snow in the Arctic. You could conceptually think of it as more fresh water coming down rivers, also into the North Atlantic. Fresh water pouring into the North Atlantic is a bad thing for the great overturning circulation of the Atlantic, and also this other subcirculation, like we would call the subpolar gyre. Basically, what happens naturally, quote unquote, is the surface waters of the Atlantic Ocean are heading northwards. They're evaporating fresh water to the atmosphere that makes them saltier, and they're cooling down as they head towards the pole. And that's getting saltier, getting colder, makes the water denser, makes it so dense it can sink from the top of the ocean to the bottom on either side of Greenland. But if you pour extra fresh water into the surface of the ocean in the North Atlantic, you can break that sinking. We call it deep convection. That's an immediate tipping point, but then it has this knock-on consequence. You're breaking a major, major part of the climate, a major redistributor of heat, and a thing that sets climate and weather over great swathes of the planet. So serious knock-on tipping point there. And we know from Earth history that when we weaken or break the Atlantic overturning, we can tip the breakdown of the monsoon in West Africa, we can severely disrupt the monsoon in India, severely disrupt the South American monsoon that basically is the rainfall for the Amazon. So you could just tip away the Amazon rainforest. Oh, and by the way, you leave a load of heat behind in the Southern Ocean because you haven't transported it north, and heating the ocean up is the biggest risk for the Western East Antarctic ice sheet. So it starts to look horribly like, oh dear, we started one thing and then we just lost control of the situation because we tipped all these other things.
And coral reefs, I guess, as well.
Yeah, they would be in the casualty list there because you would have redirected the Gulf Stream, but you would actually have left a lot of heat in the tropical Atlantic that you'd otherwise been transported away. So certainly for the tropical corals in the Atlantic, they'd be in big trouble.
Tim, I've got some more terminology for you. In reading around on this topic, which I think anyone listening to this would believe now is absolutely terrifying, one thing that comes up over and over again is the idea that the climate is a complex system. What does complexity mean in this case? Why is it important that that's the case?
Complexity of a system is a way of expressing its highly interconnected, causally interconnected. Mm. Things in one place influence things in another place or another time, in fact. And there's a richness to that interconnection, that web of causality. An indigenous American would talk about the web of life. The web of life is a classic sort of expression of a complex system. As scientists invented terms like ecosystem or earth system to give labels to specific complex systems, I would say fundamentally the economy, of course, is a complex system, one we've kind of constructed. But in all the cases we're trying to express, there's this rich causal coupling, and that includes these things we call feedback loops, delays, all sorts of interesting, we call it dynamics, can then emerge in a complex system. And then there's a subcategory. We sometimes talk about complex adaptive systems. And we put the word adaptive in there when we've got empirical reason to say, look, this system isn't just complex, it's got some evolutionary qualities. We have all kinds of language for this, but essentially we're expressing that this might be a system that can actually change its function over time, in some cases improve its function over time, but also could break down in the same way a living system can break down.
In your Tipping Point report, you mentioned that most existing assessments, most importantly, the Intergovernmental Panel of Climate Change reports, mostly focus on linear climate change. Whereas if I understand it correctly from our discussions, tipping points mean that climate change can evolve very non-linearly. Does this mean that we are fundamentally mischaracterizing and potentially underestimating climate risks?
Yes, is the short answer. And there's another way to look at it. One way to portray where the climate science community are at is they often concentrate on the middle of a distribution of possible futures or outcomes. And I'm busy telling people we need to pay more attention to what's going on in the tails of the distribution. Because if the things in the tail of the distribution have a really big impact, then when you think through a risk lens, you don't just think about the likelihood of stuff, i.e. what's in the middle of the distribution. You've got to multiply likelihood by impact of event or outcome. And then you've got to multiply that by exposure to that impact and vulnerability to it. And when you mentally switch to a risk lens, suddenly, bang, oh, we really need to be concentrating more on these tipping point outcomes, their reversibility, their abruptness, the way the harm can escalate. The trouble we've got is almost cultural. Anyone who works in finance and risk actually has no problem grasping this because it's their job to deal with risk all the time. But in climate science, we're a slightly different culture, I think, and it's proved unbelievably difficult. I continue to have this discussion or argument with my colleagues to say we've been looking at the problem the wrong way and we really got to make more of an effort to look at this through a risk lens. I think what happens is then people say, oh, you're just an alarmist, Tim, for concentrating on these outcomes. And I say, no, I'm not an alarmist. Maybe I'm just a natural risk assessor. People would use the metaphor like you wouldn't get on the aeroplane if someone told you there was a 1 in 100 chance it was going to fall out of the sky. Presented with those kind of situations, we all have the right inbuilt kind of way of responding. It's almost how we're presenting the climate situation that's wrong if we fail to present it through a risk lens.
In your guest lecture that you gave to my climate finance class at Cornell, you mentioned that the high risk estimates of when climate tipping points might be crossed by authoritative bodies like the IPCC have fallen from, if I remember correctly, around +3 or 4 degrees of warming down to around 1 or 2 degrees. What does that say about the importance of avoiding each 0.1 degree of warming? And what does it say about the importance of trying to meet 1.5 rather than 2 degrees of warming?
I give you my personal risk assessment. We reviewed over 250 papers to try and synthesize all the information we could find on this stuff. We could conclude that we're already at some risk of tipping points by the time we get to 1.5 degrees C. At 2 degrees C and above, I think we're in deep trouble, to put it as politely as I can. Kind of hope I'm wrong most of the time when I come to that conclusion. Anyone who thinks that where we're currently heading under legally binding policy commitments, which is maybe 2.7 degrees centigrade, anyone who thinks that that's fine, or even the economists who've argued that it's optimal, needs their head examining. Things would have broken down, both in the climate, but also in societies, as they're responding in sometimes functional, but sometimes dysfunctional ways to things that are kicking off.
Let's take this to its limit, Tim, because, as you say, some people think that you're an alarmist, but in the paper that you're one of the authors of, Climate Endgame, Exploring Catastrophic Climate Change Scenarios, you consider a scenario of human extinction. Is this actually possible, that that might happen?
It's an inevitability eventually that we're going to go extinct, because yeah. Your average species lasts 6 or 7 million years. So it's certainly possible. What we're discussing is, can we bring about our own extinction, whatever it means? We talk in the paper at length about how climate obviously isn't operating in isolation. We're busy, tragically, seeing wars kicking off in the world again. We've still got a major nuclear arsenal out there. There's biological and chemical weapons. There's all sorts of other risk factors that are human owned, if you like. And there's ways of imagining how those risks could intersect. Nobody likes to think that that's the way things are going to end up, but that isn't the point. In risk assessment, you've got to look across the full spectrum of possibilities and look at particularly bad outcomes. You obviously try to rule them out. And as I said, I would really like to be wrong on this, but I just don't think it's a wise strategy to proceed just saying none of this stuff can happen when we can see plausible ways that it could. It's like sleepwalking, that if you voluntarily choose not to look at all the range of outcomes and try to assess them better, it's a foolish move, because you're just going to approach the future woefully under-equipped.
So what are the scenarios that you envision could lead to these very catastrophic climate outcomes?
In my own work, I started looking at, with a load of colleagues, at extreme heat and humidity, which can literally kill you and is tragically literally killing people thanks to climate change, as heat waves have struck through Asia last year, 2023, and probably building again now, tragically. It's not a particularly difficult exercise to map out how the number of people exposed to potentially fatal heat and humidity escalates wildly as the temperature goes up. I mean, escalates into the hundreds of millions and then on upwards. Of course, people exposed to that level of risk are not going to just sit there and take it if they can get away. But then we come back round to the discussion about, okay, hundreds of millions, order of magnitude, people
on the move
and moving, because even if they're not suffering fatal heat and humidity, the ability to grow staple crops and get secure water sources is failing them. I can imagine a world where we welcome those people in and we all migrate quietly and happily towards the poles. It's just not the world we appear to be living in. On the contrary, we seem to be unable, for the most part, tragically, to embrace or even conceive of a huge collective reorganization of where we are having to live in order to flourish. Instead, what do you imagine? Escalation of conflicts. But those conflicts can then readily be fatal. It is undoubtedly pretty hard for us to wipe ourselves out completely, and that's not really the point. I think we'd all agree it was an existential risk and a tragedy if we had a major breakdown of societies, and that there would be many, many casualties.
Now that we've learned about some of the risk-based science of climate tipping points, what are the implications for asset pricing and global asset allocation?
Yes, at which point we turn to Patrick. Hello, Patrick. You've been listening to what Tim had to say. Now, the workhorse models of finance today, we talked about how climate is a complex system, and Tim explained how that has important consequences. Do these finance models take that into account at the moment?
I think it's very important to talk about tipping points as often as we can, because as far as I can understand, it's not on policymakers' radar screen. The framing of climate policy transition policy mitigation is in terms of the highly simplified targets, no more than 1.5 degree or 2 degrees. And what people hear when they hear those targets, they hear, if we were to reach 1.5 and we were, however, to implement all these policies we're talking about, then we will stay at 1.5. That somehow the problem is solved. What's important in the analysis of tipping points is it's a dynamic system, and there's no such thing as you stay at a certain level of temperatures. It's the system pushes you into different states. Tim didn't elaborate on this, but we can go into what's called a hothouse climate, which means plus 8 degrees centigrade or 10 degrees centigrade. And we were having the discussion earlier about extinction. That seems to be is approaching the kinds of natural states where we would have extinction, or certainly a very large scale of population. Coming back to Tim's question, there's no sense in which any of these tail risks are being considered in any serious way. Finance has a bad record in taking account of tail risks. The history of financial markets is every so often you have a financial crisis. Major event, that's a form of tail risk event. Has it been forecasted? Has it been anticipated? Typically not. And here we're talking about a tail risk that's totally outside of the knowledge of financial analysts. So how could they take that into account in any serious way?
As you describe in your Green Swan report, Patrick, most finance scholarship is backward-looking, studying historical, oftentimes linear relationships between variables. Does climate finance scholarship today typically consider the climate as a linear or as a non-linear and a complex system?
The short answer is it's not considering complex systems. And maybe the elaboration is to say that the analytical tools people use in finance and in economics generally, are built around the idea of a steady state. So it's linear, but it's stable, and there may be shocks, and then we come back to the stable outcome, the steady state. Now, this idea that there is no steady state, that's really not part of the typical analytical tools people use.
How would incorporating climate tipping point risk affect asset pricing theoretically?
That's a very difficult question, Alisa, because one thing is to understand the tipping point risk, and then the next thing is to understand what do you do about it? How does society respond? How do economies respond? How do policymakers respond? There's a huge amount of uncertainty there. Now, one possibility, that's I think not an unreasonable one, is there is no adequate response. That we may, even in the next 2 years, already cross tipping point, and then there will be a lot of reports, a lot of talk, a lot of lamentation. We've crossed the tipping point, and then political paralysis, business as usual. And then what will happen? The consequence of tipping point is huge physical damages. Tim Lenton pointed that out. If you have the monsoon pattern shifting in West Africa or in India, that's going to mess up all these economies, destroy lots of assets. In other richer parts of the world, similar things will happen. Insurance companies will refuse to insure those assets. People will be facing increasing risks, increasing damages. You could see how that could easily affect so many different parts of the economy and therefore of the financial system. What you won't necessarily do, which is the sad part, if we continue business as usual in a hotter world, in a riskier world, it won't mean that we should stop investing in oil companies because nothing will change. Oil companies will continue to extract oil, sell it, will continue to burn fossil fuel. There'll still be a profit to be made. So you see, that's quite a complicated question when it comes to asset allocation.
So asset prices are, of course, determined as the expected value of future expected cash flows discounted back to today. So I guess, in principle, if you would think about trying to capture tipping point risk in asset pricing, you might try to better capture the tail risk that, let's say, companies that are in a monsoon region might no longer get these cash flows. So do you think it's possible to use the projections of future cash flows and the discount rates to capture these outcomes where in entire regions' cash flows might not be able to be reaped anymore?
the main challenge you'll face is that it's a complex system like the climate, but with a social system overlaid on top of the climate system, which is also highly complex, and the economic system is highly complex. This can go in so many different directions. What you can predict, I think, with some confidence, some robustness, is that as the climate warms, as physical damages become more intense and more frequent, there will be lower economic growth globally. Now, where exactly that materializes in the world, that's maybe a little harder to predict, but there will be lower economic growth and there may be substantial output losses. I think agriculture is an area where I would really be worried about a warming climate.
Patrick, I take your point about how incredibly difficult it is to put this into the models used by the financial sector for pricing. But these are real risks. And so you could argue that it is literally their job to do it. And also, the people who are doing asset pricing are very, very smart people with access to a lot of resources. So why is there just none of this?
I wouldn't say there is none of this. I think that maybe the first order question for financial analysts is what's going to be the policy response in the short and medium run. We see a tipping point being crossed. Will there be a policy response to phase out fossil fuels? And will it be at a really material scale or not? And if you're a hard-nosed realist in financial markets, you might say that policy response is not coming. Uh-huh. And then you base your analysis on that.
Would the change in capital allocation, if climate tipping point risk is adequately priced, help avoid these tipping points to be crossed in the first place?
More generally, awareness of the risks and how they get gradually priced in financial markets is part of the process of raising awareness in society at large, in the economy at large, and awareness of policymakers. Financial markets, the large financial institutions, huge political clout. Imagine if you had the top 30 bank holding companies in the world. Those include some of the large US bank holding companies like JP Morgan. If you had JP Morgan say it's our priority to change policy towards the climate, and we will do everything we can to promote policy change wherever we are in the world. And we will build a coalition of all our peers to push in that direction. That will have huge political impact. We're just at the beginning here. Financial players, very sophisticated players, are now increasingly talking about climate change risk. Financial markets are taking it into account gradually. But we haven't yet had the policy push to reduce those risks coming from the largest, most influential players.
Tim, can I bring you back in here for a second? Are you finding that the financial sector is interested in what you have to say? And do you agree with Patrick's diagnosis of what the challenges are here and perhaps the potential that if these risks are priced, it might have a positive effect?
Yeah, I definitely agree with Patrick's portrayal of the state of play, but I also find a keen interest from the financial sector in this issue. I've been speaking recently at the Global Association of Risk Professionals meeting and the leading groups of actuaries and also accountants, and working myself with the Institute and Faculty of Actuaries, trying to drum up attention to this issue. And now reports by all accounts of my friends in the financial sector are getting widely read. Working with one of the leading pension funds, USS, in the UK, and helping try to bring this thinking into their strategic asset allocation. And I am also working with a couple of the leading impact asset managing companies to also try and bring some of this knowledge through. So yeah, there's appetite to try to grapple with this stuff. As Patrick was suggesting, it also requires deep cultural change because out there, I discover to my slight horror in the financial sector, they've contained risk into this very bounded space of alphas and betas in asset allocation. And they're completely staring at the gnat while swallowing the camel, as we would say, some of the time. You need to break out of this incremental, as Patrick was saying, as everything is just a sort of little delta incremental thing. And we're still the ball at the bottom of a big valley and everything's okay, folks. We're near equilibrium. We've been doing this with the pension fund USS. You basically got to tear that up and be willing to take a blank sheet of paper and say, okay, let's reconsider the space of possible scenarios of the future. Let's think qualitatively about this first. We've got to think about some major dimensions. How much is the private sector going to act or not act? How much is the public sector governments going to act or not act? And then the climate itself is its own dimension. Is it going to go more linear or really non-linear and tipping? And we've then mapped out that space and then started to say, let's give them names to those futures. There's a tipping point with Trump gets elected, Trump doesn't get elected. Bring all of that into the mix. And you can only really do that to begin with in a narrative way. Of course, you want to try and quantify your things you can quantify. And so we took one tipping point scenario and we just started to work through one that could actually hurt by 2030 because the sector's a near term in its concerns. You end up doing an exercise where you're then trying to back translate that into their ways of doing things. And you might conclude, as we've just been discussing, that the standard way of doing things has to change because otherwise you'll keep staring at the gnat and swallowing the camel and things will come and hit you hard. The great news is, hey, a few of these actors are switched on enough that they want to have a go and open their minds to how could this change our practice.
What would you recommend as the roadmap that other financial institutions could take to better price climate tipping point risk when they are deciding to invest in assets and also when they consider how to allocate their investments across capital?
I should let Patrick make the recommendations. From my perspective, as someone who's still trying to learn the sector and how it works, what is the path? You have to first engage with the issue and do some basic learning about it. And then you get to a point of, what do you call it, understanding the issue. And then you've got to think about how can we act on this? So that's bound to be a journey. But the key thing is to recognize that if your business is managing risk and you get your brain on this and you conclude this is a serious risk and it's a risk of a kind we're just not used to dealing with, at least it should stimulate us to work together to work out how can we bring price and bring that risk in.
We need to say much more clearly to investors and policymakers that we are very close to the edge. I don't think that awareness is there in most places, decision-making places. We're very close to the edge. And we can no longer afford procrastination, hesitation, you know, looking in the other direction, dealing with other problems that seem more pressing. This is the most pressing issue we're facing. And then a lot of things follow from that.
Thank you so much, Timothy Lenton and Patrick Bolton.
So I've got some further reading. The Global Tipping Points Report, that was launched at COP28, 6th of December 2023. You can find it as a download at global-tipping-points.org. Also, a couple of papers that Tib was co-author on. First of all, Kemp et al., Climate Endgame, Exploring Catastrophic Climate Change Scenarios. And that was published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, volume 119, number 34 in 2022. Ripple et al., The 2023 State of the Climate Report, Entering Uncharted Territory. That was published in Bioscience, volume 73, number 12. And Patrick Bolton et al., The Green Swan 2020. You can get that as a download from the Bank of International Settlements at bis.org. One of the other authors on that was Frederick Sommerma, who you might remember from one of our previous episodes.